Welcome to the new No Illusions show. That's what I meant to say. The No Illusions podcast on the podcast network. My name is Cameron Riley. Long time between drinks, folks. Apologize for that. Thanks to anyone who's still listening. It's been a crazy few months. What can I tell you? I've been traveling all over the place. I've been to Thailand. I've been to Nicaragua. I've been to Miami. I've been to Melbourne with the cigar business. We launched the building business. Still doing the digital strategy consulting to a range of clients. And, you know, boyfriend, father, all the usual stuff. But podcast is still in there. So, got a bunch of things I thought I should talk about today on the show. Just me, no interview, one of those things. I thought it might be a few things to get you to start thinking about while you're driving to work or at the gym or wherever it is that you listen to these things. I'm going to start with talking about Nicaragua. We'll probably talk a little bit about Obamacare, a little bit of philosophy, a little bit of about some of the stuff that I've been reading recently, share a few thoughts with you, see how it goes. Nicaragua, really fabulous trip. So for those of you who have never listened to the show before or haven't been reading my blog or Twitter lately, a few months ago I got involved in a business called Podomo Cigars. Never been a smoker, never in my life have I been a cigarette smoker, but matter of fact, I hate cigarettes. But I have enjoyed the odd cigar smoking. Now you might be thinking, you know, what's the difference between cigarettes and cigars? Well, quite a lot. And I might take this opportunity to explain some of that to you if you don't know much about cigars. And but you know, I think I had my first Cuban cigar at a New Year's Eve thing 15 years ago down in Melbourne and really enjoyed it. Thought, wow, this smells great, tastes great. In fact, I can remember my first the first ever time when I thought I might like a cigar. My grandfather used to smoke stinky little cigars and they smelled a little bit sweet, a little bit spicy. I actually didn't mind the smell of those. But then when I was about 18 or 19 and I bought a secondhand chess book from a secondhand book stall, Merchants of Fairness was the name, run by a guy called Rod Cameron down in Melbourne. I remember it well. I spent a lot of money on books there over the years. Anyway, I bought a chess book from there once, and it was by a great Cuban grandmaster called Capablanca. The book was written in 1924 or something like that. And I remember taking this book home and studying its yellowed pages and just getting this rich, sweet, earthy smell out of it, and realizing it was probably the cigars that the Cubans were smoking while they were, you know, reading this book and learning from this book. And yeah, I guess that sort of started my interest that one day I'd like to smoke cigars. Okay, so then fast forward a few years, I had my first cigar, I think, at a New Year's Eve dinner in Melbourne, loved it. Didn't know anything about what I was doing, but thought, this is nice. And then I would have one every now and again, once a year or so, and sometimes on a golf course, sometimes at a dinner, that sort of thing. And then when I was in Corsica 18 months ago, nearly 2 years ago, the trip to the Napoleon conference where I met Chrissy, my girlfriend, she said, the very first night I met her, she said, hey, look, a few of us are going to smoke these Cuban cigars we bought. Being Americans, they were excited about having Cuban cigars. She said, would you like to join us? And I said, yeah, I don't have a cigar though. She said, well, you can share mine. And we did, and that was it. We fell in love and history was made. So anyway, we smoked a few cigars while we were in France. After Corsica, we ended up in Paris, and I know I took a few of these Cuban cigars back to Paris with me. And I remember one night, Chrissy and I hired some bikes, and it was Bastille Day, and we rode our bikes along the Seine down to the Eiffel Tower, and we sort of lay a little bit to the side of the Eiffel Tower in the park there, smoking these cigars. Midnight, Bastille Day, and it was. The beginning of a love for talking to Chrissy while we're smoking a cigar. So then when I got back to Australia, I ended up being a regular visitor at the cigar bar in the major cigar cafe that my friend Philippe runs down in South Brisbane. And then when I was starting to do some podcasts on single malts last year with Andy Anderson, I mentioned to him that I was interested in doing some shows on cigars, and he said, well, I know this guy, Jason Nelson. He's just started importing these very high-end premium cigars, and you should catch up with him. So I was introduced to Jason. Jason and I became mates. He is the guy that has the rights to importing Perdomo cigars into Australia, and you know, I started smoking regularly and have ended up as his business partner, and you know, we're building the cigar business, and it's very exciting. We do love the cigars. So one of the questions though that people always have about cigars is, are they bad for your health? And the answer, of course, is yes, cigars are bad for your health. Most things that you enjoy are bad for your health. Wine, coffee, scotch, rum, beer, pizza, McDonald's, cheese, salami, ice cream, you name it, they're all bad for your health. The question is, to what degree are they bad for your health? And the same question needs to be asked of cigars. Now, tobacco is just bad for you, as all those things are. But there's a big difference between cigars, particularly what we're talking about, which is premium, hand-rolled, naturally crafted cigars from very carefully aged tobacco leaves, and cigarettes. Cigarettes are full of chemicals. They're designed for a quick hit. You inhale them, they go into your lungs. You don't inhale cigars. You sip a premium cigar. You bring in a little bit of smoke. You let it roll around your mouth. You blow it out again. It's a bit like those, you know, the hookahs that you fill with apple or strawberry tobacco, and you just bring it into your mouth. It's all about flavor. It's all about, you know, the smell, the aroma. You do get a nicotine hit from it, but there's a lot of nicotine, obviously, in a big fat cigar, but you're not inhaling it into your lungs. And you certainly don't do it for the nicotine hit, as cigarette smokers do. Yeah, smoking a premium cigar after a dinner or at a special event or a celebration is more like enjoying a fine wine or a fine single malt or a fine rum. It's about the palate, it's about the experience, and, you know, if you talk to most cigar smokers, they'll tell you it's about slowing down. Actually, Jeremy Oliver, who's one of Australia's top wine critics, Jason and I were having dinner with him in Melbourne last week, talking about some joint events that we want to do together. Jeremy was saying, you know, the cigar is all about exhale. It's all about just stopping. It takes about an hour to an hour. It takes between sort of 45 minutes and an hour and a half to smoke a cigar, depending on the size of it. And you can't really do anything else during that time. So it's a great opportunity to sit down with somebody that you love, or a friend or a group of friends, and just relax. And typically you'll talk politics, philosophy, science, business, whatever it is, but you relax. And, you know, one of the biggest causes of death in Australia is stress. And so, you know, strokes and that sort of thing, which are often brought on by stress, heart attacks. And cigars, for me, is all about relaxing, settling down at the end of the day with people I care about, having good discussions, and just, you know, forcing yourself to spend an hour just coming down out of a busy day and relaxing. Anyway. But I did a blog post on cigars and health up on the Perdomo blog, perdomocigars.com.au, and I quote from a 1998 report that was put out by the US National Cancer Institute. It was written by a guy called David M. Burns, called Cigar Smoking: Overview and Current State of the Science. And I'll read you the quote here, where he says, first of all, the addictive potential of cigars is lower than that for cigarettes. But he also says, where's the bold here that I'm looking for? Over three quarters of cigar smokers who have only smoked cigars report that they never inhale. And he says, when cigar smokers don't inhale or smoke few cigars per day, the risks of all causes of death are only slightly above those of never smokers. When cigar smokers don't inhale or smoke few cigars per day, the risks are only slightly above those of never smokers. It's about 2%. No, 2%. There's a 2% increase according to his chart. So, you know, it's not as bad as you might think, according to the science. But you know, obviously, I'm not going to tell you that it's good for you. As all those other things aren't good for you, we try and do it in moderation. How did I get onto that? Oh, Nicaragua, right. So as part of the Podomo business, I went to Nicaragua a few weeks ago. That's where Podomo's farms are, where the factories are. It's where the cigars get grown, cured, fermented, and manufactured, rolled, basically, all hand-rolled. And it was an amazing experience. As you know, I'm sure, if you've ever listened to this show before, I have an interest in the politics of that part of the world, Central America, Latin America. And this was my first opportunity to experience one of those countries firsthand. Unfortunately, I was only there for a couple of days and it was all business. So I didn't get a chance to talk to many of the locals or hang out with them. But I still had an opportunity to brush up on my Nicaraguan history before the trip. And I thought I'd share it with you because it's a good case study, a good example of what the people of this part of the world have had to deal with over the last couple of centuries and why they are so hard off today. You know, Nicaragua, there's something like 47% unemployment, I think, in Nicaragua, and something like 80% of the population earn less than $2 a day, two American dollars a day, most sort of down at the $1 a day. It's quite tragic. Now, obviously, this was a country that was run by the Spanish from about the time of Christopher Columbus's trip, 1492, on to the early 20th century when Spain, had a major war, the Spanish-American War, with the United States, and they pulled out of most of their assets. Most of the countries they'd invaded in South and Central America. But it didn't end there. So in 1909, in Nicaragua's case, the United States got involved. They basically sent warships into the area. November 18, 1909, they sent about, I don't know how many warships, but they sent a bunch of warships to the area after about 500 revolutionaries, including two Americans, were executed by the order of the president. There was a revolution going on at the time. And one of the things that the US was motivated by was the Nicaragua Canal. Now, you've probably heard of the Panama Canal, but before there was a Panama Canal, they had plans to build a Nicaragua Canal. They basically wanted to connect the Pacific to the Atlantic. And they were going to do that via Nicaragua, basically just build a big canal through the middle of Nicaragua. Now, you know, some of the people there didn't really want that to happen, including the president. Well, I was just checking GarageBand because I thought it shut down, but it must have been something else. So there was an internal conflict going on involving some Americans. So the US then sent warships down after these revolutionaries were executed by the order of President Zelaya. Interesting, Zelaya. Zelaya was the name of the president who was recently, the subject of a coup in Honduras, but a different guy. So the US justified the intervention, as they always do, claiming to protect US lives and property and probably democracy. The U.S. Marines then occupied Nicaragua from 1912 to 1933, except for about a nine-month period in 1925. They occupied Nicaragua from 1912 to 1933, 21 years. And they installed a family of dictators before and during that period called the Chamorro family, C-H-A-M-O-R-R-O, Chamorro. And the Chamorro family were, basically conservative dictators and controlled the government through most of that period. And they signed a treaty with the U.S., giving the U.S. control over the area of the canal where they were proposing to build the canal. But then the U.S. Eventually pulled out. But what happened towards the end of that period, there was another guerrilla war that was started that was led by a guy called Augusto Sandino, S-A-N-D-I-N-O, Sandino. He was a guy who fought a guerrilla war against the conservative regime. And he was basically the reason why the US Marines pulled out. He was, fighting a war against them. There was a change of government there. And he refused to sign this change of government too. He refused to sign the sort of deal that the new conservative government was signing with the US in return for pulling out. And then he basically led a guerrilla movement. He went up into the mountains and led a guerrilla movement against US Marines for about 5 years. And eventually there was, the US pulled out eventually. And he eventually signed a peace treaty, or agreed to sign a peace treaty, with the head of the newly elected government, who was a guy called Somoza. Now, Somoza invited him to a meeting in Managua in 1934, February 21st, 1934. Managua is the capital of Nicaragua. And he was going to sign a peace treaty. Somoza agreed to his terms and granted him amnesty and land for an agricultural colony, retention of an armed man. But when Sandino turned up to the meeting, Somoza had him assassinated, and then assassinated hundreds of other men, women, and children that were part of Sandino's band of revolutionaries. So that was in 1934, and then for the next 50 odd years, the people of Nicaragua were basically run by the Somoza family, father and son. It was a very, very brutal dictatorship, run initially by a guy called Tarco Somoza. And it was completely supported by the United States, had economic and military support from the US. The reason being is that, he did what they wanted. I mean, one thing that you have to understand about the United States is, despite what their propaganda machine will tell you, the United States doesn't really care about democracy. What the United States cares about is obedience. If you're the dictator of a country, they don't care really what you do, human rights-wise, democracy-wise, as long as you do what they tell you to do. As long as you give them access to your resources, as long as you let them sell their shit to your people or sell your people to them at cheap rates, give them access to your natural resources at a good price, they'll pretty much let you do what you want to do. And such was the case with the Somoza family, completely supported by the US for, half a century. The father, Tarco Somoza, was assassinated in 1956 by a poet. One thing you have to know about Nicaragua is they love poetry. They are the only country probably on the planet where poets are considered to be royalty. Sandino was a poet. All of the national heroes of Nicaragua, including their current president, Daniel Ortega, are poets, as was the guy Rigoberto Lopez Perez, a 27-year-old Nicaraguan poet who assassinated Somoza in 1956. Somoza was attending a party meeting to celebrate his nomination for the presidency when he was assassinated. After he died, his son, Luis Somoza de Bayal, the eldest son, was appointed president and took charge of the country. But he was only in power for a few years and died of a heart attack. Then came President René Chic Guterres, who was a puppet of the Somoza family, and one of the other Somoza sons, Anastasio Somoza, who had been trained at West Point in the United States, took over the National Guard, and then he took over the presidency after Chic. Now, he was incredibly brutal, this guy. Nicaragua did experience some economic growth in the 60s and 70s under his leadership, mostly because they started to industrialize. And they, became a fairly fast-growing economy. It was fairly stable. Foreign investments grew, but it was very corrupt. And Somoza, you know, basically was taking a lot of the money that was flowing into the country. It wasn't going to the people, which is typically what happens when you have these, you know, dictators who do a deal with the US, say, yes, you can invest your money in here and we'll give you everything we want. We'll give you access to resources and you can build infrastructure. But then they pocket all the money and it doesn't go to the people. Then in 1972, there was a major earthquake in Managua, similar to the one they had recently in Haiti. And it destroyed nearly 90% of the capital city. Major, major earthquake. And it just didn't get rebuilt. Even though there was aid money coming in from, you know, various countries around the world, including the United States, it basically just went into Somoza's back pocket, and he, you know, didn't really spend much of it at all in redeveloping Managua. So that started to annoy not just the people of Nicaragua, obviously, but also the businesses that had invested in there. But what happened then as a result as well is there was the rise of the revolutionary movement, mostly led by the Sandinista Liberation Front, known by the acronym FSLN. And that was started by a guy called Carlos Fonseca. And it was named after Sandino, who I told you about before. So the Sandinista National Liberation Front. And they were a fairly tiny revolutionary party through most of the 60s, and Somoza treated them pretty brutally whenever he could get his hands on one. But they started to build a revolutionary movement in Nicaragua, somewhat similar to what Castro had done in Cuba in the 50s. And it all sort of came to a head in around about 1978 when Pedro Chamorro, who I mentioned the Chamorros from earlier on that were supported by the US in the sort of 20s and 30s, one of their descendants was now the editor of the national newspaper La Prensa, and he had become an opponent of Somoza. He was also an opponent of the Sandinistas, but that's another story. And he was assassinated. And most people concluded it was because he'd been criticizing Somoza. And that kind of brought everything to a head inside of the country. The revolutionary element, led by, again, the Sandinistas, really started to build. And they managed to create massive uprisings across Nicaragua, working with some of the other revolutionary movements. And they finally took power in Nicaragua. Somoza left the country, taking a lot of money with him. He was assassinated a little bit later on, I think in Paraguay, where he had disappeared to. And the Sandinistas took over the country. Now, you would think, hooray, the people of Nicaragua are now going to have an easier story, but that's not what happened, because in 1981, Ronald Reagan became president of the United States. Now, until this point, the United States had kind of kept out of what was happening in Nicaragua for a few years. Under Jimmy Carter, he didn't really get involved and you know, didn't try and interfere with what was happening with the FSLN. But Jimmy Carter, you know, left, and Reagan became president, and Reagan decided he was going to bring down the FSLN and reinstall, you know, a dictator in Nicaragua who would, you know, do what the US wanted. Because, of course, you know, when the revolutionaries took power, they wanted to nationalize all of the interests in Nicaragua. Obviously, lots of sugarcane, lots of tobacco is produced out there, lots of coffee, and there's some mining and some other things as well. You know, because again, the US doesn't care about the people or human rights or democracy. What they care about is obedience. And the Sandinista government that was led by Daniel Ortega, even back then, obviously wasn't interested in supporting what the US wanted. They wanted to build an infrastructure for the people. They wanted to improve education. They wanted to improve healthcare. They wanted to improve access to agriculture, property rights, The things that revolutionary governments are usually fighting for, leftist revolutionary governments anyway. But there was a problem for Reagan in directly interfering. There had been some legislation passed in the United States around about in the early 80s, preventing the United States from providing direct funding or support for the counter-revolutionary movement in Nicaragua. Now, the counter-revolutionary movement were called the Contrarrevolucionarios, and it was shortened to the Contras. So Reagan, for the first couple of years, had been directly supporting the Contras. They were sort of based out of Honduras and Costa Rica, and they were getting economic and military support. Reagan imposed a full trade embargo on Nicaragua, the usual sorts of stuff, which, you know, cripples a country. The people don't get access to medicine, to infrastructure stuff, food, stuff that they need because of trade embargoes. But then, Congress passed a law stopping Reagan from being able to support the Contras directly. So what he ended up doing was continuing to support them illegally by covertly selling arms to Iran, then channeling the proceeds down to the Contras so they could fight the government of Nicaragua. And this was all, you know, illegal. It was secret. It was kept secret for quite a few years, for 4 or 5 years. And it finally came out in the late 80s. John Kerry, so senator back then, actually did a report and concluded that they were using these illegal arm sales. Now, it was also illegal to sell arms to Iran at the time. Iran was in the middle of the Ayatollah Khomeini's government. This is how crazy the US is, right, too, when these things happen. 1983, when they started the Iran-Contra deal, remember, the US was supporting Iraq, run by Saddam Hussein, giving him, you know, economic and military support to fight Iran, because the Iranians in 1979 had kicked out the US-supported dictator, the Reza Shah, and installed a theocratic government led by the Ayatollah Khomeini, because there was a brutal dictator supported by the US, as always, and the people finally rose up. And so the US didn't like that, so they were supporting Iraq to fight Iran. Meanwhile, they're also selling Iran weapons to fight Iraq covertly and then funneling those monies to the Contras to fight the revolutionary government in Nicaragua. I mean, just messed up, you know, just... And the people of America didn't know. But then anyway, it eventually all came out. A guy called Oliver North took the rap for it. He was the main guy running the operation for the NSA, I think it was. National Security Council, it was called back then. He took the rap. He went and did some time. Reagan sort of said, oh, I didn't know, or I did know, or I'm not sure what I knew. And Reagan was a senile old fool by this stage, as he was for most of his presidency. I mean, Reagan was a complete puppet. I mean, when Reagan got voted in 1981, it was the first time when the corporations of the US realized they could actually run a complete puppet for president and win. The guy was an actor, for fuck's sake. They managed to run a complete idiot puppet and turn him into a president. He didn't have a clue what was going on. And they, you know, and Cheney and Rumsfeld, who were part of his administration, and George Bush Sr., who'd previously run the CIA, just, you know, went hell for leather. They managed to, you know, get a pretty boy ex-actor and make him president. And there was a major coup for the corporate interests of the US. Anyway, so, of course, during all this period, so this is like 10 years now since the revolutionaries took power, the Nicaraguan economy is still stuffed because of the trade embargoes. You know, they're constantly having to fight wars against the Contras that are being funded by the US. It was just the people of Nicaragua have just been suffering endlessly for centuries. In 1984, the International Court of Justice, in regard to the case Nicaragua versus the United States of America, found the United States of America was under an obligation to make reparation to the Republic of Nicaragua for all injury caused to Nicaragua by certain breaches of obligations under customary international law and treaty law committed by the United States of America. But the United States told them to go fuck themselves. Then the Sandinistas got voted out of power in 1990, you know, mostly because the people were kind of sick of the ongoing wars with the US, and I think suspected that if they put somebody else in power, the US might cut them some slack, which they actually did. But in 2006, 16 years later, the FSLN got back into power after some funny changes to the electoral law, which enabled him to get a majority. And Ortega is now president of Nicaragua again. But that's the history of Nicaragua. As I said, the poverty is astounding. Here's some stats. Nicaragua's GDP is about $16.7 billion. And the GDP per capita is about $1,000 per capita. You know, it's horrific. Let me say that again. Where did I get those numbers from? Okay, no. Nicaragua is the second poorest country in the Americas. Nicaragua's nominal GDP stands at $6.5 billion for 2009, increasing to $8.5 billion by 2014. There you go. So it's a very, very poor population. 48% of the population live below the poverty line. 80% of the population live on less than $2 a day. It's just horrifying. But, you know, so here's the difficult thing for me. Okay, so Perdomo Cigars has their factories there. A, because there's really good... the reason the tobacco is growing over there is because the soil is very, very good. A lot of very volcanic area, a lot of very good soil, climate conditions for growing coffee, tobacco, sugarcane, etc. But also it's cheap because the people are poor because they've been ravaged by the United States and by Spain before them. So how do I feel about that? Are we exploiting the people of Nicaragua? Well, yeah, kind of, I guess. It's hard to figure out where do you draw the line between exploitation and, well, you know, we're helping them feed themselves. You know, if international companies don't go and build factories there, the people will starve. So the good thing about Perdomo, and one of the reasons I went over there to see for myself, is that Perdomo runs a great operation that, you know, I'm actually quite proud of. They pay people three times what they would get anywhere else. Still not, you know, a Western wage, but they get paid very, very well by Nicaraguan standards. The working conditions are fantastic. We went through every factory, went through every shed. The factories are all very well lit, very, very clean, great ventilation. They're cool. The people all look happy. They were smiling. They were chatting to us. We spoke to a few of them outside of the factory, and they said, you know, how good the Perdomos treated them and how excited they were about working there, how grateful they were to have a job there, etc. A lot of them have worked there for a very long time. In fact, we met a couple of people that had left Perdomo because another cigar factory offered them more money, and then they end up coming back to Perdomo because of the way that they get treated there. They have medical staff on board. You know, they work reasonable hours. You know, they knock off at 5. We were there and saw everyone leaving on their bikes at, you know, 5 or 6 o'clock. So, you know, it's a very well-run operation. And Nick Perdomo, the founder of the company, who we spent some time with in Miami, said to us, you know, happy workers make good cigars. And we want to make the best cigars in the world. You can't have unhappy, unwell, tired, you know, people producing premium cigars. It just doesn't work there. So they all have, you know, ergonomic setups and good chairs that are tilted at the right angle, that have cushions on them and all that kind of stuff. And they take breaks and et cetera, et cetera. They do work really hard, but they also are treated very well. And consequently, it's a very, very high quality product. So that's the Nicaragua story. I really wanted to tell it to you just by way as an example of what the people of Latin America have been through. You know, we see them now, and it's a, you know, very poor country, and it's very easy, particularly for a lot of Americans, to blame that on the revolutionary government. Well, look at what they've done. They've destroyed the country. No. The dictators that were supported by the United States for decades and decades and decades before them destroyed the country. And then when the revolutionaries took over, like with in the Castro example, America continually tries to invade them, keep them in a state of war, and places trade embargoes on them to cripple the economy. So you can't blame it on the revolutionary governments because they're Marxist or communist or whatever. By the way, you know, interestingly enough, the Nicaraguan government is a democracy, obviously, as we've discussed. The Sandinistas got voted out. So, you know, they're a leftist government, but also they run a democracy, just in case people are confused. It's a presidential representative democratic republic, whereby the president of Nicaragua is both head of state and head of the government, and they have a multi-party system. Executive power is exercised by the government. Legislative power is vested in both the government and the National Assembly, and the judiciary is independent of the executive and the legislature. So, you know, you can run a leftist country run by, you can have a country run by a leftist government that, you know, is also a democracy, just in case we were confused by that. I have people sometimes who seem to think that Marxism and socialism and communism can't coexist with democracy, and that's just not the case. Well, I talked about that a lot longer than I thought. Where are we at? 36-minute mark. Let's just talk about Obamacare, I guess, briefly while I have you. You know, that Obama managed to get his legislation passed this week. And it's a, you know, it's something, I guess. But I've been very skeptical about Obama and very cynical that he actually was going to achieve anything or even try to achieve anything. And this is something. I guess it seems slightly better than what the people there had before. At least they'll have insurance of some form, or many of them will. But there's a great article on the ABC's site written by a guy called Stephen Long that somebody on Twitter sent to me called What's Wrong with the Obama Healthcare Plan? And I'm going to read this to you because I think it's a very, very well-written article. Says President Obama's healthcare system is flawed in its basic design. It's being billed as a historic reform, but it actually entrenches a failed status quo. His reforms are designed to push more people into private health insurance, but the centrality of private health insurance is part of the problem in the United States, not the solution. That America's healthcare system needs reform is not in doubt. The United States is the only rich nation that lacks universal healthcare coverage. In the world's most affluent country, tens of millions of people can't afford to see a doctor or have an operation. It has by far the most expensive healthcare system in the world, yet its health outcomes are poor. Consider how America's system stacks up against our own. In the US, on OECD estimates, healthcare expenditure is close to 17% of GDP, about double here. Yet its adult mortality rate is almost twice as high. Why so? I was having this discussion with people when I was in America, and they're going, because it's all the gangbangers killing each other. I don't think that's... I'd like to see the stats, but I don't think that's the case. That's also their excuse for why there's 11,000-odd gun deaths a year versus the 100 or whatever it is we have in Australia every year. Anyway, it's a good article. Go read it. I'll put a link up on the website. You know, if you haven't read the overview of what Obama's healthcare package involves... It's you know, basically going to force the majority of Americans into health insurance. They have to buy it, though, from a private insurance company, and they'll be given some subsidies from the government to the tune of about $500 billion. They'll be given subsidies in order to funnel this money. So, you know, it's basically like the Iraq War was, like the financial bailout was. It's basically another scam where corporations are just getting a $500 billion handout from the taxpayers, you know, from the government, but it's the taxpayers' money that's come from taxation, right? So the money is basically going out of the taxpayers' hands straight into the pockets of the corporations. Now, they need to provide some insurance and some services for that, but, you know, it's basically a massive payday for them. And a lot of it doesn't take place for a couple of years. I think it's 4 years before it takes effect for adults. And one of the things that it forces the insurance companies to do is to give insurance to people that have pre-existing conditions, which is almost impossible over there now. But again, it just seems to me like in large part a massive rort in favor of the insurance companies just getting this $500 million handout. Now, originally when Obama started talking about it, they were supposed to have like a public health care system or an option for public like we have in Australia and the UK and France and Canada. But that's not where it ended up. It was pretty crazy when I was in the US too. Some Americans, most of the Americans I spoke to over there were right-wing Republican Christians. And nice people, very nice people, don't get me wrong, but, you know, completely deluded when it comes to how these things work. And they were all referring to Obama as a Marxist. Oh, he's a Marxist, he's a socialist. I was like, hold on, he just approved a $1 trillion bailout of Wall Street last year. Do you know anything about Marxism or socialism? A Marxist or a socialist would never, never, ever consent to bailing out Wall Street. Wall Street would be the mortal enemy of a Marxist or a socialist. They would relish the collapse. Or they would have just, you know, centralized it, you know, bailed them out, taken complete control and just run it as a central financial, government-run, state-run operation. Or, you know, they would have given it into the hands of the people, truly. A true communism isn't what we saw in Russia or China. That's state oligarchy. True communism, you know, these things, the means of production is run by the people in the form of communes, small groups of people who get together and run their own factories and their own businesses, etc. Their own, you know, forms of social government, local government. So that's what a Marxist would have done. I mean, Obama is the complete opposite of a Marxist. And also this deal, you know, they're giving money to insurance companies. That's not something a Marxist or a socialist would ever do. And, the Fox Ublicans are calling it socialized medicine. They're giving money to insurance companies. There's just nothing remotely socialist about that. It just goes to show that most Americans, you know, the ones that talk about this stuff anyway, have got absolutely no idea what they're talking about. And they were shocked that I stood up to them when I was over there. A lot of them were like, obviously never come up against people who know more than they do, you know. I was in conversations after, you know, a night of cigar smoking. These guys would be going on about Obama being a socialist. I'd go, sorry, but that's just biggest load of nonsense I've ever heard, and would explain why. And then they had no comeback. There was nothing they could say because they have no idea what they're talking about. They get everything that they know from Fox. They've never read a book about socialism or communism or Marxism. They know nothing about what they're talking about. So anyway, yeah, the healthcare thing, I mean, is it a step forward? Is it a good thing? Does it make Obama a good guy? Well, he's actually finally done something after a year. But is this change? Yes, we can change that sort of stuff. I don't think so. Maybe. I mean, people are going to get health insurance, and we can't say that that's a bad thing. But at the same time, he's just funneling more money back into the insurance companies, the big corporations, which will then use that money. And this is the financial sector, let's recall, that collapsed out of pure greed a year ago, only to be bailed out by the government. They're going to have another $500 billion now with which to buy lobbyists, with which to buy control of the media and advertising to fight any true reform. And, it's not really going to contribute to any genuine systemic change or reform in the United States. So let's not have any illusions about what's going on over there or about who Obama works for. He bailed out Wall Street a year ago, just before he became president. He was the guy that got the vote pushed through Congress. He just bailed out the insurance companies, gave them $500 billion. He bailed out GM. You know, let's be very clear. This guy's biggest source of corporate funding for his presidential campaign was Goldman Sachs, we know who he works for. There should be no illusions about that. With that, I guess that's a show, folks. Sorry it's been so long. Hope there's a few of you still listening. And we'll talk to you again soon, folks. Keep the faith. And just remember, you know, we got to get out there and have these discussions with people on Twitter, on the blogs, in real life. We have to engineer the world that we want to have 50 years from now, or if we don't engineer it, somebody else will. Cameron out. Yeah.